Sunday crowd is because of religious devotion within the community, but really, it's because of El Festín, the grand dinner that follows Mass. All of us who live here must work it. My place is in the cafeteria line. It's only after dinner that we're finally free. If I'm lucky, we'll finish by 4. Then we're not due back until the sun sets. This time of year, it comes a little after 6. We rush to the showers, quickly bathe, brush our teeth and our hair, then dress in our Sunday best, identical black and white outfits that leave only our hands and heads showing. When most of the other girls have fled the room, Adelina walks in. She stands in front of me and fixes the neck of my tunic. It makes me feel much younger than I really am. I can hear the throng of people filing into the nave. Adelina remains silent. So do I. I look at the gray streaks in her auburn hair, which I hadn't noticed before. There are wrinkles at her eyes and mouth. She's 42, but looks 10 years older. I had a dream about a girl with raven hair and gray eyes who reached her hand out to me, I say, breaking the silence. She wanted me to take it. Okay, she says, unsure of why I'm telling her about a dream. Do you think she could be one of us? She gives the collar a final tug. I think you shouldn't read into your dreams so much. I want to argue with her, but I'm not sure what to say. So instead I utter, "It felt real." Some dreams do. But you said a long time ago that on Lorien we could sometimes communicate with each other over long distances. Yes, and right after that I would read you stories about a wolf who could blow down houses and a goose who laid golden eggs. Those were fairy tales. It's all one big fairy tale, Marina. I grip my teeth. How can you say that? We both know it's not a fairy tale. We both know where we came from and why we're here. I don't know why you act as if you didn't come from Lorien and you don't have a duty to teach me. She puts her hands behind her back and looks at the ceiling. Marina, since I've been here, since we've been here, we've been fortunate to learn the truth about creation and where we came from and what our real mission is on Earth. And that's all found in the Bible. And the Bible isn't a fairy tale? Her shoulders stiffen. She furrows her brows and flexes her jaw. Lorien isn't a fairy tale, I say, before she can respond. And using telekinesis, I lift a pillow from a nearby bed and spin it in the air. Adelina does something she's never done before. She slaps me. Hard! I drop the pillow and press my hand to my stinging cheek with my mouth wide open. Don't you dare let them see you do that, she says furiously. What I did right there, that's not a fairy tale. I'm not part of a fairy tale. You are my Sapon, and you are not part of a fairy tale. Call it what you will, she says. But haven't you read the news? You know the boy in Ohio is one of us. You have to. He could be our only chance. Our only chance at what? She asks. A life. And what do you call this? Spending our days living the lies of an alien race is no life, I say. She shakes her head. Give it up, Marina, she says, and walks away. I have no choice but to follow. Marina. The name sounds so normal now. So me. I don't think twice when Adelina hisses the name at me, or when one of the other girls in the orphanage yells it on the way out the school doors, waving my forgotten math book. But it hasn't always been my name. Back when we were aimlessly looking for a warm meal or a bed. Back before Spain and Santa Teresa, before Adelina was Adelina. I had been Genevieve. Adelina was Odette. Those were our French names. We should change our names with every new country, Adelina had whispered when she was Signe and we were in Norway, where our ship landed after months at sea. She'd chosen Signe because it had been written on the woman's shirt behind the counter. "What should my name be?" I'd asked. "Whatever you want it to be," she'd said. We'd been at a cafe in the middle of a bleak village, enjoying the heat from the mug of hot chocolate we'd shared. Signe had stood and retrieved the weekend's newspaper from a nearby table. On the front page was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. Blonde hair, high cheekbones, deep blue eyes. Her name was Birgitta. My name had become Birgitta. Even when we were on a train and the country zipped past the window like trees, we'd always changed our names, if just for a few hours. Yes, it was to stay hidden from the Mogadorians, or anyone else who might be following us. But it was also the one thing that raised our spirits among so much disappointment. I'd thought it was so much fun. I wish we'd traveled over Europe several times. In Poland, I was Minka, and she chose Zali. She was Fatima in Denmark, and I was Yasmin. I had two names in Austria, Sophie and Astrid. She fell in love with Emelina. "Why Emelina?" I'd asked. She laughed. "I don't know exactly. I guess I love that it's almost two names in one. Either one is beautiful, but you smash them together, and you get something extraordinary." In fact, I wonder now if that was the last time I heard her laugh, or the last time we hugged, or made proclamations about our destinies. I believe it was the last time I sensed she cared about being my Saipan, or what happened to Lorien, what happened to me. We arrive at Mass just before it begins. The only available seats are in the very last row, which is where I prefer to sit anyhow. Adelina shuffles to the front, where the sisters sit. Father Marco, the priest, begins with an opening prayer in his always somber voice, and most of his words are muffled beyond recognition by the time they reach me. I like it this way, sitting through Mass with detached apathy. I try not to think about Adelina smacking me, filling my mind instead with what I will do when Elphestine finally ends. None of the snow has melted, but I'm determined to make it to the cave anyway. I have something new to paint, and I want to finish the picture of John Smith that I started last week. Mass drags on forever. Or at least it feels that way, with rites, liturgies, communion, reading, prayers, rituals. When we reach the final prayer, I am exhausted, and don't even bother pretending to pray like I normally do, and instead sit there with my head lifted and eyes open, scanning the backs of the heads of those in attendance. Almost all of them are familiar. One man sleeps upright in his pew, arms crossed and chin touching his chest. I watch him until something in his dream startles him awake with a grunt. Several heads turn his way as he gathers his bearings. I can't help but smile, and as I look away, my eyes find Sister Dora scowling at me. I drop my head, close my eyes, and feign prayer, mouthing the words that Father Marco recites up front. But I know I've been caught. It's what Sister Dora thrives on. She goes out of her way to catch us in the act of doing something we shouldn't. Prayer concludes with the sign of the cross, finally bringing an end to Mass. I'm up out of my seat before anyone else, and I hurry from the nave to the kitchen. Sister Dora may be the largest among all the sisters, but she shows surprising agility when it's needed, and I don't want to give her the chance to catch me. If she doesn't, I might escape punishment. And I do, because when she enters the cafeteria 5 minutes later as I'm peeling potatoes beside a gangly 14-year-old named Paola and her 12-year-old sister Lucia, she only glares at me. "What's up with her?" Paola asks. "She caught me smiling during Mass." "Good thing you weren't battled," Lucia says out of the corner of her mouth.
I nod and go back to what I'm doing. As fleeting as they are, it's these small moments that bring us girls together, the fact that we share a common enemy. When I was younger, I thought commonalities like this and of being orphaned and living under the same tyrannical roof would unite us all as immediate and lifelong friends. But really, it only worked to further divide us, creating small factions within our already small group. The pretty girls, huddling together, LaGuardia accepted, but still a part of their crowd. The smart girls, the athletic ones, the young ones. Until I was left all alone. A half hour later, when everything's ready, we carry the food from the kitchen to the serving line. The crowd of waiting people clap. At the back of the line, I see my favorite person in all of Santa Teresa, Hector Ricardo. His clothes are dirty and wrinkled, and his hair is tousled. He has bloodshot eyes and almost scarlet complexion to his face and cheeks. Even from as far away as I am, I notice he has a slight shake in each hand, as he always does on Sundays, the only day in the week he swears off drinking. He looks especially rough today, though when he finally approaches, he holds his tray out and fixes on his face the most optimistic smile he can muster.
"And how are you, my dear Queen of the Sea?" he asks.
I curtsy in return. "I'm doing well, Hector. And you?"
He shrugs, then says, "Life is but a fine wine, to be sipped and savored."
I laugh. Hector always has some old adage to share. I first met Hector when I was 13. He had been sitting outside the lone cafe on Calle Principal, drinking a bottle of wine by himself. It was mid-afternoon, and I had been on my way home from school. Our eyes met as I passed.
"Marina, as of the sea," he had said,
and I'd found it odd that he knew my name, though I shouldn't have, since I'd seen him every week at the church pretty much since the day I'd arrived.
"Come keep a drunk man company a few minutes."
I did. I'm not sure why. Maybe because there's something entirely agreeable about Hector. He makes me feel relaxed, and doesn't pretend to be somebody he isn't like so many other people do. He exudes the attitude of, "This is who I am, take it or leave it." That first day, we had sat and talked long enough for him to finish one bottle of wine and order a second.
"You stick with Hector Ricardo," he had said when I had to get back to the convent. "I'll take care of you. It is in my name. The Latin root of Hector means to defend and hold fast. And Ricardo means power and bravery," he'd said, thumping his chest twice with his right fist. "Hector Ricardo will take care of you."
I could tell he meant it.
He'd gone on. "Marina, of the sea. That's what your name means. Did you know that?"
I told him I did not. I'd wondered what Birgitta meant, and Yasmin, what Emelina was rooted in.
"That means you are Santa Teresa's own sea queen," he had said with a sideways grin.
I'd laughed at him. "I think you've been drinking too much, Hector Ricardo."
"Yes," he'd replied. "I am the town drunk, dear Marina, but don't let that fool you. Hector Ricardo is a defender all the same. And besides, show me a man without vice, and I'll show you one without virtue."
Years later, he's one of the few people I can call a friend. It takes 25 minutes for the few hundred people to receive their due today. And after the last person leaves the line, it's our turn to eat, sitting away from the others. As a group, we eat as fast as we can, knowing that the quicker we clean up and get everything put away, the sooner we'll be on our own. 15 minutes later, the five of us who worked the line are scraping pots and pans and wiping counters. At its best, cleanup takes an hour, and that's only if everyone leaves the cafeteria after they're done eating, which rarely happens. As we're cleaning, When I know the others aren't looking, I throw into a bag the non-perishable items I plan to take to the cave today. Dried fruits and berries, nuts, a can of tuna fish, a can of beans. This has become another weekly tradition of mine. For a long time, I convinced myself I was doing it so I could snack when painting the cave's walls. But the truth is, I'm creating a stockpile of food in case the worst arrives and I have to hide. And by the worst, I mean them. Chapter 6. When I finally walk outside after changing into warmer clothes and rolling my bed blanket under my arm, the sun is shifted to the west, and there's not a cloud in the sky. It's 4:30, which gives me an hour and a half at best. I hate the rushed quality of Sundays, the way the day creeps by until the very moment we're free, at which point time flies. I look to the east, and the light reflected off the snow causes me to squint. The cave is over two rocky hills. With as much snow as there is on the ground now, I'm not even sure I'll see the opening today. But I pull on my hat, zip up my jacket, tie the blanket around my neck like a cape, and head east. Two tall birch trees mark the trail's start, and my feet turn cold the second I enter the deep drifts. The blanket cape sweeps the snow behind me, erasing my footprints. I pass a few recognizable fixtures that show the way. A rock jutting out past the others. A tree that leans at a slightly different angle. After about 20 minutes, I pass the rock formation identical to a camel's back, which tells me I'm almost there. I have the faint sensation of being watched, possibly followed. I turn and scan the mountainside. Silence. Snow. Nothing else. The blanket around my neck has done a great job of hiding my tracks. A slow, prickly feeling crawls up the back of my neck. I've seen the way rabbits blend into the landscape, going unnoticed until you're almost on top of them. And I know that just because I can't see somebody doesn't mean they can't see me. 5 minutes later, I finally spot the rounded shrub that blocks the entrance. The cave's mouth looks like an oversized groundhog hole cutting into the mountain, and that's exactly what I had mistaken it for years ago. But when I'd look more closely, I knew I was wrong. The cave was deep and dark, and back then, I could see next to nothing in the little light that entered. There was an implicit desire to discover the cave's secrets, and I wonder if this is what caused the legacy to develop, my ability to see in the dark. I can't see in the dark as easily as I can see in the day, but even the deepest recesses of black glow as though lit by candlelight. On my knees, I knock away just enough snow to be able to slip down and in. I drop the bag ahead of me, untie the blanket from my neck, and sweep it across the snow to hide my footprints, then hang it on the other side of the opening to keep out the wind. The entrance is narrow for the first 3 meters, followed by a slightly wider passageway that winds down a steep decline large enough to navigate while standing, and after that, the cave opens, revealing itself. The ceiling is high and echoing, and its five walls smoothly transition into one another, creating an almost perfect polygon. A stream cuts through the back right corner. I have no idea where the water comes from or where it goes, springing up through one of the walls only to disappear into the earth's deeper depths. But the level never changes, offering a reservoir of icy cold water regardless of the time of day or season. With a constant fresh source of water, this is the perfect place to hide. From the Mogadorians, the sisters, and the girls, even Adelina. It's also the perfect place to use and hone my legacies. I drop the bag beside the stream, remove the non-perishables, and place them on the rock ledge, which already holds several chocolate bars, small bags of granola, oatmeal, cereal, powdered milk, a jar of peanut